I'm sorry about the delay. I was enjoying New Jersey Transit hospitality for the last hour, so it just wanted to keep me there longer. Anyway, so so for those of you who don't know what I work on, I and my students who I think are hiding out in the corners of the room, the guy chomping the dessert over there, and two of them, the dude with the austere beard and the guy raising his hand next to him. So those are three of my students. We work on designing computer systems for all fields of use, and most of our work is focused on the data center space. In the last couple of years, we sort of made this shift to looking at systems that are at the intersection of neuroscience and the traditional computer systems that we design. So to shed a little bit of context on how this happened, about a couple of years ago, I was reading neuroscience textbooks. So if you go to enough faculty meetings, your notions of what is fun gets dramatically altered. So you start doing that type of thing. I was doing that, and then I got this fellowship at Princeton, which was really nice because it allowed me to get access to all their labs. And so I've learned how to do a pile of things in the last 2 years, including animal surgeries, craniotomies, some of that data I'm going to show you today. And so I've been working on implanting chips in the brains of small animals like mice, all the way to larger animals like sheep and pigs. I personally am doing that, yes. I shouldn't do that, but you're going to have to sit through an hour of this now. I'm sorry. I'm going to be talking to you about designing systems to do just that, fortunately or unfortunately. So the two big messages that I want to drive home in this talk are, I'm going to put up on the first slide. So message number one is that neuroscientists are heavily reliant on computer systems to understand the brain. And these computer systems face some extreme operating constraints when we think about traditional performance and energy, metrics with which we judge all computer systems. So the systems we implant in brains face really extreme versions of those metrics. I'm also going to show you that cross-layer coordination is a very effective means of mitigating some of these problems. What I mean by cross-layer coordination is that if you look at a picture like this, where you have your application stack, your system software and hardware, one of the concepts that we're used to perhaps is that if you get the hardware or the software to learn about what the other layer is doing without breaking the abstractions, there's a lot of inefficiencies that you can wean out that sit between these layers. What's perhaps a little bit more surprising, and what I'm going to be showing you about today, is that there's also opportunity to get the hardware to be very fluid about how it interprets what's going on in the biology of these systems. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about what systems neuroscientists are currently using to study the brain. So the answer is they're using a whole wide spectrum of them. Everything from embedded chips that sit inside implants under the skull, all the way to large-scale data centers and supercomputers on which we're modeling the brain. Right, so let's talk a little bit about each of these areas and what the constraints are there. So I'll start with implants. So implants are used for many reasons. The first reason that we use them is basically to understand the brain. And we do this by designing implants which probe cortical tissue in small-scale animals from rats all the way to larger ones like monkeys and such. And so the idea there is you get the animal to perform certain tasks under some constrained environments. You have these probes that measure how the neurons are firing, and you try and find the link between the low-level neuronal physiology and higher-level behavior and such. That's not the only reason you use implants. Actually, implants are currently in use pretty widely to treat diseases as well. So if you look here, this is an example of something called deep brain stimulation. The idea here is you place electrodes in the limbic system of humans, really, and you use this to basically stimulate errant neurons that are representative of pathologies like Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, motor neuron disease, that type of thing. And by stimulating the neurons at the right frequency, you can mitigate some of those symptoms. Cochlear implants, retinal implants, they're used in similar ways to fix, hearing and visual pathologies. And perhaps some of the more aggressive things that we're seeing today are implants that are used to help people who are paralyzed, right? So it's a paralyzed monkey and it's a paralyzed person, and in both these examples, there's an implant that's being placed on the motor cortex of the brain, and this implant basically reads how neurons are firing there, figures out how these subjects would like to move their limbs, and thereby activates chips that might reside on the various portions of the limb or control robotic arms. So this type of thing has been demoed, it exists, people are working on this actively. Now, here's the challenge in terms of computer systems. It used to be that on those systems, we'd get away with simple embedded devices because all we do is basically read how the neurons are spiking and relay it off to some station off-board to do the processing that we were interested in. But now we're doing something different. We moved from these 8-bit controllers on those implants to embedded cores and FPGAs. Things like ARM cores are actually now fairly standard. So if you look at a whole range of recent studies on monkeys, pigs, sheep, you start seeing some of these chips showing up. And these chips are complex. I mean, they have caches in them, pipelines, branch predictors. I mean, these are proper microarchitectural structures in here. Right? So why is this? Well, basically, it boils down to the applications. We started doing things like real-time processing on these implants. Right? So if you want to move a limb, you have to do it in real time, which means that the processing burden on these chips is getting higher and higher. So now this presents a problem, right? We're making the chips more complex. But if you look at what a typical implant looks like, and there's many layers, we'll sort of go over it in detail. But the two that should stand out here are the layers that are involved in basically providing energy to this device. And because of the form factors that you deal with, the battery life is really constrained. Now on top of that, the problem with these devices is you often use them in a setting where you want the animal to perform certain tasks if you put an implant in it. And even though wireless charging capabilities may be there, the wireless charging is restricted to some place like a cage or something like that, and you want the animal to roam around freely for hours to days even. And so there's a real energy issue here. You need to be extremely judicious in your use of battery life in these devices. To give you a sense of why CPUs, these more complex CPUs are a problem for the energy standpoint. Let's look at some data. So this is some data I've collected off of some collaborators who designed an implant on the motor cortex of monkeys. And so in their first generation of implants, this black bar tells you what fraction of system energy went on CPUs. And they were using these 8-bit microcontrollers at about 10 microcontrollers. So these are some of the simpler ones. But some of the newer generations of CPUs, you can see this black bar going, right? And in fact, the sort of application that I'm showing you for which this data corresponds to is just simply compression, but some of the stuff we're doing on these implants is now more sophisticated. You know, things like feature extraction, you know, more sophisticated signal processing, all the way up to something pretty complex, which is predicting tissue movement. So one of the problems with these implants is you plug them in, and the brain tissue actually moves around in the fluid. And so you have to sort of predict how the probes are changing distance-wise from the neurons that they're plugged next to. So predicting how the tissue is moving is pretty complex. And you start looking at some of those algorithms that are being run. On the CPU, you start seeing 40% of system energy just going to that. Right? So this is clearly a trend that is a problem because we want to make the CPUs more complex. That's trend one. Trend two, they're getting more energy inefficient. So we've got to fix this. So that's on the implant side, right? That's one side of the coin. Now the other side of the coin that neuroscientists are concerned with is this large-scale brain model, right? So the problem here is basically over the last 30 years, neuroscientists have become, they've come up with more and more accurate models for various subcomponents of the brain, right? So we know fairly accurate models now about the amygdala, the hippocampus, thalamus, you know, that type of thing. But the main problem is we don't know how these things fit together. For some reason, our models of the system-wide interactions between these subcomponents, they really break down. They don't seem to mimic what goes on in real life. And so there's a big push in the neuroscience community now to design these large-scale modeling frameworks that model how those subcomponents interact in order to understand system-wide pathologies like autism, schizophrenia, and such, you know, chronic pain and that type of thing. Something like this may also help us understand, you know, how Trump got voted in, perhaps. So this is extremely important, right? So these are the types of projects that are ongoing that are trying to solve this problem. And the basic issue that they run into is that there's a massive data dilution when you look at those frameworks, right? So those frameworks use imaging data or video data that's picked up from the brain tissue of various animals. If you look at a mouse, if you get 60 minutes of high-resolution optogenetic video of this thing, you can spit out tens of petabytes just from that. And if you think that a mouse is, well, you know, what about something simpler? Well, you take a fruit fly, if you image just 1% of the brain of this thing, that can get out terabytes of data in some of these frameworks. That's a lot of data to deal with. And if this is compounded by the fact that these frameworks that we're discussing, oftentimes to enable you to do good science, they use these fancy visualization packages so that you can see the data and they're interactive. So This is something called the BrainX3 simulation framework. This maps the connectome of various animals. And the basic idea is you're allowed to puncture portions in the connectome, small connections, and then see how that damage percolates system work. And that places a huge computational burden because you're trying to do this interactively. Now, here's the interesting, yeah.
What are the connections there?
So the connections could be anything from standard neurons to special neurons, and so you're plotting you're plotting all the neural activity that's going on between all of the neurons and all parts of the brain. So it's an enormous amount of data. So here's the deal with this. Now, in some sense, everything I've explained to you builds up to a very standard big data problem. Right? When you go to a lot of talks, you hear about the fact that we're churning through a lot of data. And that's true. I mean, these frameworks sort of, they are another representation of that problem. What is perhaps a bit unique is that the sheer scale of the data we're dealing with makes some layers of this system, which otherwise function okay, they make them suddenly acutely stressed. Right? So one of the things that my lab is really interested in is this layer of computer systems called virtual memory. And it turns out that virtual memory overheads in these types of frameworks is really high. Right? So a quick primer on virtual memory, and this is sort of, Nridhul gave an excellent talk last week where he touched on virtual memory, so I'm sort of, riding on his coattails a little bit. But the basic idea behind virtual memory is that, it's a very classic concept. What it allows programmers to do is to express their data structures in terms of a flat, linear, and easy to reason about virtual address space, right? So this saves them the burden of having to work out how their data structure should map to a complex assortment of physical memory devices, which you see on systems today. Instead, it's the hardware and the OS's job to figure out how those virtual addresses map to physical. Right, and this abstraction between a virtual address and a physical address has been vital to the success of computing because it's made programming easy. Right, so this is exactly the type of thing that allows neuroscientists to even write code for these large-scale simulators that they're using. But if you didn't have this working properly, every time your memory configuration changes, if you stick in a DIMM with a high capacity, you'd have to rewrite your code. Right? You obviously don't want to do that. This is all well and good, except that if you look at the overheads going to virtual memory, on some of those frameworks that I discussed on modern systems, they can be really high. Right? So this is some data that I've picked up in collaboration with industry people. And running on some of their systems, 36% to half of your system just going on virtual memory is not unusual. Right? So this is, of course, a big bottleneck as well. And so to set the stage for this talk, basically, what we've established is implants on one side. Yes. 36% of runtime. So if you take the actual execution time of these programs, using on-chip performance counters, we measure what fraction of that time goes to virtual memory alone, and it's that. Those are the numbers. Does that make sense? And just for context, I mean, you can't expect virtual memory to be free. You will pay some tax for it. But this number is just way too high. Right? I mean, what you're hoping for is maybe like 5%.
What's a typical number outside?
Okay, so there's sort of a long answer to this. If you look at the early papers on virtual memory, they're okay with a performance tax, but what they say is that if your performance tax is 5%, it's worth it for all the programmability benefits that this layer provides. Now, if you look at what's going on with workloads today, that number has been creeping up. So if you take key value stores or some graph processing algorithms that people use to look at social connections and such, you can see that number going up to about 10%, 15%. So that's bad, but this is particularly severe because of the scale of it. Make sense?
Just to clarify, cost for virtual memory is address translation, lookup, page fault, and all that.
This number? Right. So virtual memory has two layers to it. The first aspect is you translate a virtual to physical address. That's got an overhead. You might have to swap in data from your hard disk. That's got an overhead. Right? So that's a page fault. This number here, as it turns out, this is all address translation. This is not swapping from disk. And the reason is that these systems are heavily over-provisioned because they have to be interactive. So you stick in so much memory that at the beginning of your workload, you pull up everything from disk to memory and you're done. There's no page faults. This is all virtual to physical translation. Well, not all, but the large majority of it, say 95%. Any other questions? So to set the stage, this is the rough outline for this talk. These are the problems we're going to try and get. And I'm going to spend most of my time talking about implants. Specifically, I'm going to show you new ways to manage low power modes on these implants. And again, just to sort of bring us back to this picture, to give a little more context, again, this kind of cross-layer coordination is what I'm going to be trying to push for. So on this, on these more traditional-looking systems from which we run these game modeling frameworks, we're going to try and get the software and hardware to align. And on these implants, we're going to try and get the hardware to learn about the biology that the implants are embedded in. One more caveat before I move on. So one of the things that architects typically like to do is they like to come up with the simplest possible hardware that can get you good performance. And the reason for this is that simple hardware is much more likely to be correct and much more likely to be implemented. And so many of the solutions I've discussed today, I mean, you could come up with fancier solutions, you could come up with more effective solutions, but they're oftentimes harder to verify. And so some of the things we're going to put on implants, for example, are really simple hardware structures that can do the job. Right? Because verification, as you'd imagine, is very important when you're putting something inside your brain. Right? The thing better work correctly. Okay. Oh, the other good news about keeping things simple is you're likely to have things implemented in the real world. So my PhD students have actually, some of the work they've done has impacted real products. So Z, who's sitting over there, his work has recently, as of this month, been pushed into the mainline Linux kernel. So you can go run his code and complain to him if you sort of run the latest Linux distro. And my PhD student who graduated, I guess now a couple of years ago, some of the early work he did has now been implemented on AMD's chips. So the benefit of keeping things simple is that you can do something like this. All right, so with that, let's start talking about implants. And to make things concrete, I'm going to show you an implant that I've been working on, which is targeted at understanding how the cerebellum in mice works. Okay, so I was digging around pictures to show you a mouse. This is actually one of the mice in the lab that we dealt with. I don't know if you can tell, but it's eating a watermelon, so there's a lot of spiking going on in its head as it's enjoying that. This is the cerebellum of the brain. It's a portion of the hindbrain. It's involved in muscle regulation and balance. There's mounting evidence that cerebellar dysfunction leads to hallucinations and psychosis, so it's an incredibly important structure to understand. And the implants that we're putting into the cerebellum can be abstracted to look like something like this. These are centimeter cubed in volume, roughly speaking, and all the layers in them can be separated into three classes. The first one is the battery layer. I mean, I've already talked to you a little bit about this, so we can sort of skip it. Suffice it to say, you have to be very judicious in your use of this layer. Right? The second layer, which is important, is this layer which is called a microelectrode array. Okay? So a microelectrode array is basically a 4 cm by 4 cm grid of silicon needles that are used to probe cortical tissue. So this is just an example, millimeter by millimeter, not centimeter. This is an example of a microelectrode array compared against a thumb, just for reference. And these things are placed 1 to 2 millimeters deep into the cortical tissue of the brain. So if you look at the brain, and there's a lot of high resolution, really nice images you can find online, what you'll see is that along the folds, there's these sort of jumbled up flowery patterns. That's the cortical tissue. Everything underneath there where you see these lines, these are dendrites hooking up the neurons to each other. So you don't want to go off. What you want to do is restrict your probes to the top of that sort of flowery patch. You don't want to go below that. Right? So that's what the microelectrode array probes into. And the specific microelectrode array we use is something called a UTA array. UTA arrays have been in development for the last, 10, 20 years. It's something that the community knows how to use. They're not ideal, but they are the more commonly used techniques. So that's what we're going to focus. Now within the cerebellum, we're going to use that microelectrode array to monitor something called a Purkinje neuron. There are about tens of millions of these guys in the cerebellum, and this is one of the key building blocks of that unit of the brain. And once the microelectrode array reads raw data from the cerebellum, it's going to pass it through some analog logic, which is used to basically denoise that raw data and threshold it so that you get chains of spikes. And that chain of spikes is then fed from the analog to digital converter, that's what an ADC is, into your CPU so that the CPU can do something useful with it. And of course, this gets us back to the problem that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, which is that the CPU energy is going up when it's doing something with that data. So we want to fix that problem. How do we do this? It's natural, yeah.
So one question before you go on. So, all right, this is arrays of needles. And what you're doing is you're just looking for voltage differentials across the whole array all at once, and then the CPU figures out other stuff given that. Is that the analog parts to it?
Right, so each of the needles basically plugs in an area around 4 to 5 neurons or so. So it picks up local field potentials from there. So the analog logic looks at the waveforms out of there and does some frequency separation so it can then get you data about the 4 or 5 different neurons. And then that is, there's a little more processing in there to get that separation. And then you pass it through an ADC which spikes it. Yes?
How do you get the data from the chip to somebody who reads it? Meaning, is there radio sitting in this thing?
Yeah.
How much is the energy consumption of that? I would assume that's
the radio. Right, so that's a great question. So yes, there are radios on these things that broadcast the data over to another, well, so there are two types of implants. The older implants didn't actually have radios because radios were considered, it was hard to actually just physically fit them. And so they would use cabling, and there are these just gruesome pictures online of basically these implants hooked up to like tons of cables that run off into whatever system you're interested in. So clearly that's not viable. So then we transition into a world with radios, and the implants I'm working on have these radios plugged in. The problem with the radios is that the more information you send, the more tissue heat up it leads to. And the brain tissue is very sensitive. If you heat it up to more than a degree Celsius, you can induce seizures and mania in whatever subjects you're embedding these things in. So yes, there's a radio, but there's a big push now to doing as much onboard processing as you can so that you have less data transfer.
But you don't have numbers, kind of like budgets, is it? Oh, 20% of how much do you spend?
So,
on? I mean, this is significant, right? This is 30-40% of computing.
So, you know, I was showing you a graph initially where the CPU sliver was tiny. The radios in that particular paper, I think, consumed about 40% of it. I think when we get to some of these more sophisticated workloads, the radios are somewhere along 30% or so. So they're still, you know, they're pretty significant. And it depends a lot on what kinds of implants you're using, because some of these implants are single deployment implants where you put them in just one like site in the brain. But there are also designs where you see implants placed on 4 or 5 different sites, and they all sort of transmit data to each other, and then the radio becomes a bigger hall. Yes?
It's a silly question, but is it possible to tap into the energy of the body?
Actually, that's a great question. So the neurons themselves, so your brain expends about 20 watts at any given point of time. So there are people who are looking into using, fitting things on these implants that can harvest some of that energy. There is ongoing work on that. The challenge...
How does it harvest energy?
Well, if you put a piezoelectric sort of piece in there, you can pick up some of that. But the problem is that, you know, it's very hard to, it's a lot of trial and error. So until we, there's a lot of work going on figuring out, okay, well, at what depth of the brain can I get what amount of energy using this harvesting technique? And,
you can harvest in the rest of the body. You don't have to, the harvesting doesn't have to be in the brain. It could be done elsewhere.
The problem with that is if it's done elsewhere, you still need a radio to wirelessly charge the thing under your skull. And when you have a radio over there, that radio is going to heat up your brain tissues. That's just like a fundamental limiter. But there are ways. I mean, you could do things.
There are quite a few pieces of work that do deal with this. There's vibration, accelerometers, heat differences. So there's the whole technology at intermittent power, basically. But that has restrictions on what kind of computing you need to do and so on, so
yeah.
It becomes a little more...
I mean, it's doable. It's just a matter of exploring it. I think my student got angry at something I said.
One thing is, if you're going to wirelessly power these chips and implants, you can wirelessly power it from outside, and you won't be restricted by whatever energy the body can provide, because you can just carry a big battery on the back.
Yeah. All options. I mean, to be honest, this space is so nascent that there's all of this left to explore. I mean, we just don't know, I think, is the answer. Okay, so we're going to try and reduce processor energy, right? A very natural question to ask is, we are used to thinking about low power modes on these processors. Can we use some of those low power modes to reduce energy, right? And, you know, there have been people here, actually, who've done tons of awesome work on low power management of large-scale systems. So Tu has been, you know, has done a lot of work on this, Uli, Ricardo. They've looked at using all kinds of low power states. So if you look at an Intel system, you'll find these G states, C states, S states, P states. And without getting into details, what these things are is they basically allow you to trade off performance for energy savings. The idea is they allow you to maybe run the CPU at a slightly lower clock lower voltage, maybe idle the CPU. The more sort of you sacrifice performance, the more energy savings you can achieve. And if you look at processors from the embedded market to the sort of high performance space, they all tend to have some combinations of these low power modes. And the big question when you use them is, when is it okay to compromise performance? Because I'm going to save energy basically by sacrificing performance. So that's the big question in a lot of these research papers. And that's the question for us here. If you're going to use a low power mode on these ARM cores, we need to figure out when it's okay to lose performance. And so what I'm basically saying is that what we want to do is when we see interesting activity in the neurons that are spiking, we want to make sure the processor runs at full tilt. Otherwise, we go into low power mode. So this, of course, begs the question of what activity is interesting. And then sort of associated with it is, well, how well can we do with this low power mode, right? So let's start by talking about what activity is interesting. So again, the activity that we're going to probe is from this thing called a Purkinje neuron. Right? That's what we're going to study. And if you look at a Purkinje neuron, it's got two kinds of spiking activity. The first is what looks like arbitrary individual spikes that seem to happen at random. And the second one is the one we're interested in, which is something called synchronized spiking. So the deal with synchronized spiking is basically there are points in time where you see a bunch of these neurons light up at once. And the frequency with which this happens seems to be associated with what the animal that you embedded this implant in is doing. And so I'll show you, by the way, results from animals that have all kinds of stimuli associated with them and how these synchronized patterns change. Now, here's some data that I've collected off of a mouse brain craniotomy for you to see what spiking actually looks like and what synchronized activity looks like. So these are all, this lit up thing, these are all neurons in an area of the cerebellum called lobule 6 in a mouse. And I don't know if you can tell, but there's like lighting going on and firing. And occasionally things will fire, there'll be a burst of fire that looks more intense. And that's something that you can sort of ascribe to synchronization, right? So that's the type of thing that I spent lots of time looking at over the last 2 years.
Is bioluminescence, how do you get these things?
So the way this has got, the way I've gotten this data is through a technique called optogenetics, which has become this like big hot area in the last couple of years. Basic idea behind optogenetics is you rear the animal that you're dealing with, in this case it was a mouse, to express a certain gene, right? Then you do a craniotomy on the mouse and you inject in a benign virus into the brain. And when this when you shine a certain wavelength of light on an area of the brain that's been exposed to this virus, it fluoresces. It fluoresces at an extremely high resolution. And so you can see individual neurons and the connections over there. And so this picture is, that's how we've gotten this thing, okay? Now, more concretely, once you post-process some of that data, here's an image of what we were looking at. These sort of little grids, I mean, these are all individual Purkinje neurons. And this is an example of spiking because if you look at this one still, you'll see that a bunch of these guys are lighting at once. And so this is an example of synchronized behavior. Now, as it turned out, that video that I was showing you was taken when the mouse was eating some broccoli. So clearly it enjoyed itself a lot of synchronized activity. So that's the kind of thing we were probing. So we were giving the animals food. So it's not all bad. Healthy food at
it
that,
is
right?
Horrible.
All right, we're not making progress in this. Okay. We'll keep trying. So here's what we're going to try and do. When there's no synchronization, we're going to try and run at low power mode. When there is synchronization, we're going to run at nominal operation. That's the basic task at hand. And what low power mode can we use? Well, what we're dealing with is an ARM Cortex-M7. That's an implant that's really, that's a chip that's very forward-looking in terms of implants. It's something we're seeing used in some of these forward-looking setups. It's got one low power mode, which allows you to turn the clock off. Memory and storage are kept on, so whatever state you have is reserved, right? So it's literally turn off your clock, pause execution, and then when you're ready to run a nominal operation, you just pick up from where you left off. And the deal with this low power mode is that, you know, effectively power consumption is halved when you do this. So the key takeaway is, because you're idling, you better be absolutely sure that you do want to go into low power because you're not doing anything, right? So I'm going to show you that in order to do this correctly, we're going to have to predict future brain activity to get this right. Now, you might say that, well, that seems like a bit of an extreme assertion, right? What about some things we could do before that? Here's something we considered instead of brain activity prediction, something called reactive power management. Basic idea with reactive power management, and you might think of doing this, is keep the processor in low power mode. This is your microelectrode array is picking up neural activity, it's spiking. when you notice, when your microelectrode array notices that, hey, more than one neuron went off, transition your CPU reactively into nominal operation. The problem with this is that you miss a bunch of activity right before synchronization, which is of interest to neuroscientists. So this is something we're going to call lead-up activity, and this is something they care about as well. Now, if lead-up activity itself were predictable, you could sidestep this problem. But the issue is that we don't really know what lead-up activity should look like. It could be any combination of neurons firing. So we need some better way to do this. Another thing you could might consider is, well, if this synchronization occurs with a well-defined periodicity, I could just figure out what that periodicity is and transition my CPU back and forth. Now, the problem is that if you look at Purkinje neurons, they're driven by two inputs, the spinal cord and other parts of the cerebellum. And when the animal that has the implant moves around a lot, there's a lot of stray activity coming in from the spinal cord, which makes it really hard to predict when synchronized activity is going to happen. If you look at the firing rates, we're talking about anywhere between 1 to 150 hertz at which this happens. So periodicity is simply not there. What we want instead is something like this. We want, basically, as soon as we know that there's synchronization, we want nominal operation there, but we want nominal operation to occur right before it as well to pick up lead-up activity. Now, in the implant I was considering, there was one more constraint, which is that when you started seeing synchronized activity, the neuroscientists I was working with wanted to basically get 500 milliseconds of activity after that as well. So there's that additional constraint thrown into this mix. Okay? Any questions so far on all of this? Okay. So what we're going to now do is find a way to predict the lead-up and synchronized activity. That's what we want to do. And software would be a great way to do this. In fact, the most accurate way to do this might be to throw in some learning thing in software and just run with that. And the problem is, nothing is free in life, and software isn't either, right? I mean, it's going to consume CPU resources, memory resources, and such. And so while it may eventually be a good step to go in, this first series of studies that I did focused on saying, well, if there's hardware available on the chip that's used to do prediction, can we bootstrap that to doing prediction of neurons as well? And as it turns out, there's a good reason to do this, because if you look at modern chips today, and this is a die shot of AMD's Ryzen chip, you'll see all kinds of predictors on this. Caches are actually just predictors, right? I mean, they're predictors of what data you're likely to need in the future. What's even more interesting is that branch predictors are available on all your chips today. And if you look at the branch predictors that are used commercially, they're actually pretty sophisticated neural nets-based hardware. They're perceptron-based. In fact, the last guy who was a computer architect at Rutgers, Daniel Jimenez, how many of you guys remember? He's the developer of the perceptron predictors. So, you stuck with me. I have a poor replacement, but I'll try and explain to you how a perceptron predictor works as well. So, we're going to try and leverage that perceptron predictor because it's available in a lot of commercial chips today, and we're going to have that learn about the biology and help us predict lead-up activity and synchronize that as well. I'm going to show you that we can actually take an existing predictor and get accuracy of 85% in predicting future neuron spiking using that hardware predictor. And I'm going to show you that you can use this to save about 60% of the energy on this processor using that one mobile port that we have. So to start things off, let me sort of give you a quick primer on branch prediction. Most of you know this, but just to refresh our memory. Let's say you have a piece of code and you're sort of evaluating some condition. Let's say that that's the condition you're evaluating. Based on the outcome of that condition, you either execute one block of code or another block of code, where D is a branch being taken, you execute this block of code. If the branch is not taken, you execute this block of code. Now, the basic problem with this in CPUs is that evaluating that condition often takes many cycles, too many cycles for good performance. And so what we've had historically is hardware that allows us to predict which direction this branch will go in. So let's say you predict that the branch is taken, you speculatively go ahead and start doing this work over here. Once you discover that the branch was indeed the outcome should be taken, you're good, right? You've just done the work that you would have had to do just earlier. In case the outcome doesn't match what you predicted, then you have a way of squashing those instructions and steering fetch from the correct path. So this is what a branch predictor does. A perceptron branch predictor performs this prediction using a perceptron, which is a weighted sum, a hardware instantiation of this thing, right? And so what's fed into this weighted sum? Prior branch outcomes. In fact, you have a register of a bunch of prior branch outcomes there. So here, x1 to x6 correspond to branch outcomes that you saw in your history from the last branch that you encountered, the branch before that, the one before that, and so on. You feed these outcomes, what you put into these registers is whether the branch was taken or not, which basically corresponds to a single bit that tells you, hey, one, it was taken, zero, it was not taken. Those branch outcomes are fed into hardware that maintains weights, okay? So what these weights basically tell you is how correlated the outcome of the current branch I'm predicting is with a prior branch that existed, right? So if your weight is higher, that means that you have a stronger correlation for this branch with a previous branch. So if X2 is high here, it means that you have a strong correlation, W2 is higher here, means you have a strong correlation with X2, right? So, and finally, the weighted sum, if it's positive, you predict that this branch is taken, otherwise not taken. That's the way a perceptron predictor works. Turns out that I'm showing you this thing and making it look like it's super easy, but this is absolute hell to get right, because you have to train this thing. And that's the biggest problem when you design this in hardware. Right? So modern hardware has a way to dynamically update the weights and train it on the fly, so that it can actually learn about changes in the program. Yes?
In predicting an action, you said if the prediction is wrong, you simply squash it.
Yes.
But suppose there is a side effect created by this computation, what do you do with that?
So the way modern processors are designed is that you buffer a state and only commit it when you know that you are correct. In other words, there's hardware mechanisms that allow you to speculate, and if you were wrong, you don't update state anywhere. So you can roll back correctly. So let's talk quickly about how weights are maintained over here. So let's say you have this cold snippet, okay? And let's say this is your perceptron. Now, let's say you come to evaluate that branch, and at the point of evaluating that branch, these were all your prior branch outcomes, and these were the weights. And in this particular example, you can see that this weight and this weight are the largest, so the outcome of this branch, the prediction of this branch, is going to be most heavily correlated with these prior outcomes, right? Just to sort of set the stage. Now, if you perform this weighted sum, you'll see that it equals 12, I hope, unless there's a mistake in there, and you predict that this branch is taken. Now, because you predict that the branch is taken, you start executing this code, right? Now, let's say that eventually you discover that you made a mistake, that the branch was actually not taken. So what you do when this happens, of course, is you squash all the incorrectly fetched instructions and you fetch from the right path. But at the same time, you have to train this predictor so that it doesn't mispredict in the future. The way you train it is you basically, first of all, find all of the outcomes that match the outcome that you just saw. So this outcome is zero. Find all of the boxes for whose bubbles have a zero in them and increment those weights. Decrement the other weights. That's the basic idea. And once you do this, you know, hopefully you have something that is well trained through time. That's the basic idea behind a perceptron predictor. So what we're now asking is, can we take the same exact structure and co-opt it to predict neurons? So that's basically like saying that instead of storing past branch outcomes here, let me store prior neuron spiking data. So instead of taken, not taken, I want to store whether each neuron was spiking or quiet. And instead of predicting a branch being taken or not taken, I predict whether it's spiking or quiet. So this brings up two questions. One central question, which is, are neurons and branches similar at all? Because if they're not, then we can't do this, obviously. I'm going to show you that there are two key similarities that's going to make this perceptron predictor work for us. The similarities have to do with the fact that both branches and neurons show what's called correlated activity, and both show what's called phase changes, right? So let's talk about correlated activity. Here's the deal. There's lots of literature in the neuroscience space that shows that there are these things called microbands of Purkinje neurons. So these are neurons that spike together in time. In other words, there's heavy correlation between some sets of neurons that seem to be co-activated together. This is similar to branches, because if you look at code, there's often situations like this where you have some back-to-back branches, and if you know the outcome of one branch, you know necessarily what the outcome of the other branch should be. So there is this aspect of correlation in there. And this notion of correlation is exactly what a perceptron predictor is good at picking up. I mean, that's effectively what it was designed for. And again, just to show you this picture, you know, the bigger the weight, the more the correlation between that prior branch outcome and the weighted sum. So that's how those correlations are captured in the structure. So that's good news, because it means that, well, there's one similarity that we might be able to bootstrap off. The second question is phase change, right? So what I mean by this is, if you look at programs, there's like a ton of literature that shows that programs have these things called phases, where their memory behavior, branch behavior changes over time. And so branches show that kind of phase change behavior. Neurons, as it turns out, do the same thing. So that video that I was showing you, this is data collected from that same experiment. So this is a mouse with of 26, where with an implant in it, 26 minutes of activity. What I'm plotting to you on the x-axis is the firing probability of the neurons, and on the y-axis, the percentage of neurons that have that firing probability. This is the average. Now, as it turns out, when we did this experiment where we applied air puffs on the whiskers of these mice, and we wanted to see how this data changes, that's what the green bars plot. Right? So the green bars show you how the spiking rates tend to change once you start having stimulation on these mice. And so the big takeaway from this, of course, is that you need a predictor to be dynamic to pick up this behavior, because you're not going to have constant behavior throughout. And so training these weights...
Sorry, can you go back to the data is interesting. So in the green stuff, it's kind of two bumps. So
it's fine, right? Yeah.
So did that correlate to two events?
So this is speculation because it's hard to say exactly, but when you apply air puffs on these mice, you basically get a reaction where the mouse gets really still and sort of paralyzed and then starts trying to run away. And the postdoc who was working with me speculated that maybe we were seeing something like this. I mean, basically when you apply stimulation on these animals, the input to the Purkinje neurons that becomes stronger is the input coming from the spinal cord. And so that seems to be correlated with more movement. But it's a speculation. other questions? Okay, so the training is a vital part of this, right? The fact that we can do on-the-fly training is promising. It means that we should be able to adapt to these phases. Right? So I'm going to show you that the training that we can perform remains exactly the same as with branches. There's no change in the way we train these structures, meaning, okay, so let's say we predicted that something spiked and we found that it was quiet. Well, go adjust the weights that were matching, increment those, decrement the weights that didn't match, and that's how you train up the weights. So that is an abstract sort of view of the perceptron. And naturally, what I showed you is one perceptron, right? So one perceptron for one branch that you might predict or one neuron that you might predict. But you need many of these things in the chip, right? Because you have many branches to predict. So the actual hardware of a perceptron predictor looks something like this. There's a branch history register, which basically maintains all the prior branch outcomes, whether they were taken or not taken. And there's also something called a perceptron table. So the table has a bunch of entries, and each entry has the weights that you're interested in. So the way you access this structure is you find out the program counter value of the branch you're dealing with. You use that to look up an entry that's got a bunch of weights, and you perform a dot product between those weights and the prior branch outcomes. All the changes that we have to make are encapsulated in this. Instead of a branch history register, we just maintain information about whether a bunch of neurons spiked or not. And instead of using a branch program counter, we index it to the table, we assign a number to the neuron that we're trying to predict and use that to look up an entry. System-wide, the design ends up looking something like this. So you have your mouse, you have a microelectrode array reading from the cerebellum, it goes through some analog logic. That analog logic leads to a spike train, which is dumped into DRAM. So you've got a bunch of spike, quiet, a whole bunch of a sequence of bits and some defined, well-known portion of main memory. Right? Your processor is going to be dealing with all that data. It's the one that's going to be churning through that. We looked at a bunch of designs where the brain predictor is, you know, in one design we used part of the branch predictor to do this. Ultimately, what we figured out is that a better design is just to have a separate hardware structure that slots into the system bus that has access to DRAM, so it can read all the spiking data, and it can allow you to transition your processor between low power mode and nominal operation. Okay, so think of it like a device that, a piece of hardware that has a switch to the CPU, you can turn it on and off, toggle it when it wants to. And the way this entire thing works is something like this. You have your notion of time, your microelectrode array is picking up neural spiking, you suspend your CPU in low power. The first thing we do is we divide time into these things called epochs. So an epoch is going to be the basic block of time during which we're going to train and predict from our perceptrons. We experimented with a lot of different epoch times. We found 10 milliseconds to be a pretty good time because it turns out that a Purkinje neuron spikes at the millisecond scale. So this is a good match in terms of time. So at the beginning of an epoch, what we do is we train the predictor. When I say we train it, what I mean is we take a look at the neurons and the activity that the microelectrode is picking up over there. And for every one of these neurons, we train all the weights associated with that. Okay, so we bulk train. This is what I'm going to call bulk training, because you're taking all the neurons and training them. After you're done training, you use this hardware to do your prediction. And again, this is a bulk prediction in the sense that you're going to predict whether each of these four neurons is going to fire or not. The prediction you're performing is basically, it corresponds to what the neurons are going to be doing in the next step, right? And so, as it turns out, in this next step, we predict that, hey, I expect synchronization. So you can go ahead and transition into nominal. Like, this is how things work, right? So you have, what you've done with this is, during your nominal operation, you capture your lead-up activity, your synchronization, and 500 milliseconds after that. That's the system design that we've come up with. I've just papered over a bunch of design issues that could potentially occur, right? That's a super optimistic system design. So now let me spend a few minutes discussing some of those design issues. I'm going to show you that those design issues can be separated into two categories. Some issues that the biology helps us tackle, and other issues where the biology poses a challenge. So let's talk about where biology helps us. Yes?
The time gap between the lead-up activity, how long does the lead-up activity last for synchronization?
Yeah, so in this design, the neuroscientists we were working with were happy to capture 10 milliseconds of lead-up activity. That being said, we don't really, I mean, it's sort of an artificial, you know, boundary to say, hey, the only lead-up activity we care about is 10 milliseconds ahead. I mean, you could define lead-up activity as 20 milliseconds, 30 milliseconds. It sort of depends on what data you want to interpret. In this design, we went with 10 milliseconds. Does that make sense?
Do you think it would scale if you had to stretch that out? Because now you have to be learning based on increasingly possible, less predictable behavior.
Yeah. So my students have sort of brought that up a couple of times, and which is that, like, if you're trying to predict way ahead in the future now, how accurate are your predictions going to be? It's not clear. I mean, we're working on that. Some things we could do is if we know the spike shape better, we might be able to play around with the ADC so that when what the ADC is telling us is spiking, now what it's telling us is quiet, if we change the threshold, we could make it look like it's spiking, so we pick up sort of the upswing of the spike, but it's something.
Yeah.
Yes?
So in this application, it seems like false positives, like, suppose I predict that a neuron is going to fire.
Yes.
And it did not fire.
Yes.
That's better than true negatives.
Yes. Yes.
So some way to account for that.
We use reactive power management in that case. I'm going to be talking about that. Basically, what we do is we say, oh man, I made a mistake. It actually synchronized. Let's go up to nominal operation there. I've lost my lead-up activity, unfortunately, but at least I've captured my synchronization. But I'll touch on exactly that issue. Yes.
Does the synchronization, like, data look similar between, like, the same types of stimulation? Like, if you blow, like you said, you're, like, blowing air on the whiskers, does it look similar?
No, it looks very different, actually.
Okay.
So the biggest differences are so we have some data when the mouse roams around freely, and there's one when it's on a wheel. So the more movement it's performing, the more crazy firing patterns you see.
Oh,
so
yeah. More in the sense of, like, if it's the same type of stimulation, is it the same types of spikes that you're getting in the data?
Even if it's the same type of stimulation, there's variation in spiking. It's sort of very hard to, Okay, so real quick, where does the biology help us? Here are some questions that I just kind of totally sidestepped. Issue number one is, if you actually look at the perceptron papers, Daniel Jimenez made an entire sort of, he made a career out of finding these problems with perceptron predictors and then fixing them. And one big problem he found is that these things are really slow to access. Accessing this massive table takes time, and performing the dot product takes time. So if this takes too long, you run the risk of doing all of your training and predictions so late that you actually end up losing the activity you're interested in. That's issue one. Issue two is that you can't transition between power modes immediately. There's some time taken between switching between power modes, and that boils down to the same problem. If it takes too long, you might miss some of that activity you're interested in. Here's where the biology helps us. when we think of those problems, we think in terms of gigahertz level server systems, right? Because that's what they were originally designed for. But this implant is never going to run at the gigahertz scale. In fact, it runs at tens to a few hundred megahertz because of two reasons. One is that there's no need to run it quicker. I mean, these spikes don't happen quicker than a millisecond granularity. And number two, if you did run it quicker, you'd heat up the brain tissue so badly that it's a non-starter. So this is a situation where the biology helps us because, as it turns out, all the hardware bells and whistles we use to make things fit in the cycle time of a gigahertz clock fits nicely in a sort of 10 to 100 megahertz clock. So this is a total non-issue. Okay? And in fact, this brings me to my next point, which is it's kind of weird to think about transitioning between power modes based on what a branch predict is. Right? I mean, that seems like a super fine-grained operation. Again, the reason that we can do this is because the clock speed is so slow that an architectural event actually happens over longer scales of time. So, how are we doing in terms of accuracy? This is some data that I've collected. You'll see that on the y-axis, I have the percentage accuracy in predicting my neurons. On the x-axis, I've bucketed this into three types of data. One is where the mouse is under deep anesthesia. Another one is where the mouse is under anesthesia and there's air puffs supplied to the whiskers. And finally, the mouse is awake and running around. And as you can see, so this is for a 1 kilobyte predictor size. The accuracy when the mouse is under anesthesia is something like 80%. So that involves spontaneous twitching of limbs and such, so we are capturing that. Now, when we go to something where you apply a stimulus, the accuracy drops. So these are 20 to 40 PSI stimuli on the whiskers, but we're still doing 75% accuracy. Oh, by the way, the green bars are min and max, right? So it's a bunch of experiments that we did for this. Finally, free-roaming mice, more Purkinje activity, we're doing about 70% as well. I'm going to talk to you about what happens with these mispredictions, which is what Mridul asked, shortly. Okay, but before I go there, one thing I've sort of talked about today is perceptron transpredictors over and over and over. But there are other transpredictors that you have, table-based, saturating counter-based. So we've also looked at how you can use those devices to predict brain activity. They don't do as well, is the short answer. They do okay, but the gap between them, especially when the mouse is moving around, becomes bigger and bigger. Okay, here's another interesting thing about how the perceptron predictor is doing. If you actually look at the weights in the perceptron predictor, you can figure out that the weights are mimicking the underlying biology of this system. So let's say you've got a bunch of neurons, and I've kind of switched from circles to triangles to represent them for a good reason. If you look at these neurons, neuroscientists are interested in what are called parasagittally oriented Purkinje neurons. So those are Purkinje neurons that look like they're in parallel, right? So in this case, 4, 2, and 3 are parasagittal because they are lying sort of in the same way. It turned out that when we started looking at our perceptron predictor, we figured out that the weights corresponding to the parasagittal neurons on average were double the size of the other weights. So in other words, this device is actually training and picking up the correlations between the right sets of neurons. And now that gets me to Mridul's question, which is what do you do when you mispredict, right? So we're mispredicting in the awake case about 30% of the time, actually more, 40% of the time and such, so we need to fix this somehow. And there are two types of misprediction. The first of which is you predict synchronization, but the outcome is no synchronization. You waste some energy there. You transition your CPU to nominal operation, but you can transition back to low power when you realize you made a mistake. The bigger issue is this one, where you predicted no synchronization, and as it turned out, synchronization happened. Our solution is to do something reactive. So yes, we miss the lead-up activity, but we transition to nominal operation as soon as we detect synchronization. Okay, so that's the total design. Here are the energy savings from this design. Again, for anesthesia with no stimulus, anesthesia with stimulus, and an awake mouse, the energy savings for the processor are roughly 60% in the best case, and even in the awake mouse, we're not doing too bad, right? We're about 50% over there. The other way of interpreting this data is to ask, if I have a fixed battery life, how many samples overall am I collecting, right? So this data gives you that piece of information. You'll see that we can collect about 2.5 times as many samples as the baseline when we do energy management because we run the thing for longer for a fixed amount of energy. We don't do quite as well with lead-up, and that's because of some of that misprediction that I was talking about. So one thing we're now actively investigating is ways to get that lead up to 2.5x as well. And so the two things that I'm looking at that might help with this, and these are the two thoughts that I'll sort of leave you with, are focusing on neurotransmitter concentrations and messing with the weights in a more coarse-grained way. So the first point over here corresponds to the fact that right now the only input to my perceptron predictor is whether a neuron fired or not. It turns out that a lot of these implants have devices in them that can sense levels of neurotransmitter concentrations in the sort of the cerebrospinal fluid in the bloodstream of the brain. And depending on the neurotransmitter you're dealing with, if you see a higher concentration of something called a GABA neurotransmitter, you expect more Purkinje neurons to fire. So if you could detect those changes in concentration, you might be able to feed that into the perceptron as well to make more informed decisions. The other thing we're looking at is the training that I was talking about, it's done at a really fine granularity right now. It's done when a neuron spikes, it doesn't spike. But if the animal is, say, going to sleep at a specific time in the day every day, or the animal is, you know, doing some repetitive activity once in a day, once every few hours, and that activity, sort of getting to your question, corresponds to similar spiking, then you might be able to save the state of the weight somewhere and restore them into the perceptron when you know that that animal is repeating that behavior. And that might allow you to get better prediction accuracy and sort of lift up some of the loss of beta activity. Now, I had some other stuff to talk about, but I think I'm just going to end it at that because the next portion will take another 15 minutes or so, and I think I'm already at the 1 hour mark. You have any questions? We have your data. Yes?
I was wondering if there is no far simpler solution to the energy problem. Why couldn't you put the battery outside of the...
That means that you're going to put a cable through the skull, and these things have basically that they cause scarring and tissue damage if you have something protruding through the skull. This is actually, people have done exactly that. They started with cabling that went through the various, there's 8-9 layers of the brain, and you have a cable running through them. The diseases that you can pick up just because of that, sepsis and everything under the sun, people are moving away from that.
Can't you run it through the back of the, through the body essentially?
You can do all of that, but the brain has about 15 layers in them. At some point, you're going to have to puncture through some of those
layers. Through the brain.
Yes, and that is a no-go for
everyone. There is one more problem attached to this. If you run wires that connect brain to other parts of the body, then the mitral motion of the brain relative to the other parts of the body move the implant and cause additional scarring of the tissue.
The fluid is, the brain tissue is not fixed, it moves. And so remember that, like, if you've cabled it hard into some portion of the tissue, now that cabling is going to move around.
But you put in a whole processor.
Yeah, but that's just an implant on the cortical tissue rather than running a cable through other parts of the vein. And
but you can run it through the same place where you put
it. It just does not work.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
So, it seems kind of interesting here that the processor sort of gives you this binary clock or not. That's my understanding. Oh, the clock's on or off.
The low power mode.
Yeah. So, do you think you could extend the idea to something more continuous where some processors have more continuously adjustable clocks?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. So there's two parts to that. One is, if you had something where you could transition the frequencies at which you were running, for example, you probably would do a much better job of capturing some of that lead-up activity. Things kind of on. The downside is your predictor has to be a little more smart than just telling you, oh, it's either synchronized or not. You probably need to know that it's going to be synchronized with some probability. And so you could probably design something like that, but it remains to be useful. Yeah.
So one thing, if you have a hardware component of a chip that you can exploit for some other purposes, then that's all the thing. So, if I understood this right, so the idea is to take the branch predictor and basically repurpose it. Did I get this right?
So
in other words, how much additional hardware do you expect to have to make this work?
Yeah, so exactly right. So we looked at two designs. Design one was one where we did not want to use additional hardware, where we said, okay, when the branch predictor, when the CPU is in low power mode, I'll just keep a bank of my branch predictor on and repurpose that to predict neural activity. So that doesn't really require new hardware aside from additional transistor parts You need a separate PT domain to allow you to keep a portion of it on, but it's small. The problem with that is you trash your predictor state, right? So when you're now running at nominal operation, you're not adjusting to changes in the neural spiking. And when you're running at low power, you're losing the training that you did for program branches. And that can adversely affect you. So in the end, what I've sort of been playing, the models that I've been using tell me that a separate hardware structure does better, but that separate hardware structure does take area. So for the results I showed you over here, that additional area is accounted for in that energy number, and it's, just to give you a rough idea, it's about an additional 10%
This is a little big architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
You have the very low power core at the same time would be into something like that, meaning that the little guy would be basically just use a branch predictor.
Yeah, I mean, you should be able to. In fact, that might go back to a more continuous way of monitoring it. I think, yeah, you could use something like this to coordinate the scheduling of which core you're using.
So let's thank Abhishek and let people go.